Yesterday, there were some issues that I never really got to. Some things that I wanted to bring up that I thought might be useful for you to listen to, having to do with alternative means of handling rifts in the community that are represented by conflicts between the community and criminals, or between victims and criminals. I've been trying to, I think every day, mention this point that when we see conflicts or controversies or difficulties in our communities, rather than looking at these as signs of destruction or something that we should deny or try to push out of the way, that many times we can look at these conflicts as opportunities for healing and for rising to another level. And a couple days ago at one of the meals, I was sitting across from a woman who has spent some time recently back in Washington, D.C., working in a program that's through the Lutheran Social Services there that tries to reconcile criminals with the community. And so I asked her to mention a few things about that program. Mary?
I'll just say really briefly that I worked with Lutheran Social Services in Washington, D.C., with the Department of Community Justice Ministries, and basically we were trying to provide alternatives to jails and prisons on a local community level within the district. For a year, I worked with what's called a third-party custody program, which provides an alternative for people who are coming through the system right at the time that they're arrested. At arraignment, when they come before the judge, we would interview them and talk to the judge to see if we could get them out on the streets into our counseling program so that they didn't have to go to the jail. And it was a really good program for 99% of the people in the district cannot afford a bond, cannot afford a decent attorney. And many of them, most of them, didn't need to be locked up. So to give them some sort of positive program initially as they're coming through the system, I think is a really good alternative. After working in that situation for a year, we were trying to bridge the gap between judges and defendants and the community, which is a really big gap to build. I moved into the area of conflict resolution and mediation, and I think that's a really exciting area for church people to be thinking about, because there's a role that the religious community can play. And it's becoming more popular amongst church folk concerned about criminal justice, where you try to divert conflicts early on in early stage, either family disputes or landlord-tenant or that kind of thing, and work to resolve conflicts before they escalate and even get into the system. So, I mean, people are talking about whole alternative justice systems altogether. Much more concerned now about working with victims and keeping victims in mind, which is really important, I think. I think it's really important to keep reminded of the social and economic situations that give rise to a lot of the crimes in this country. And the last thing I'd want to say, because we're talking about capital punishment today, is that probably the biggest advocate of capital punishment in the state of Virginia, whom I worked, her name is Marie Deans. Her mother-in-law was murdered in Virginia, and her family did not want to see the person who was convicted of the murder put to death. Within the state of Virginia, they do have capital punishment. His case was transferred to New York, and they fought for him to get a life sentence. And it's been really inspirational to work with someone who has faith enough to feel that if you value life that much, then you can't turn around and, in the name of the life of her mother-in-law, have someone else killed. And she has since that time become a very strong advocate for the death penalty and has been very shunned by the church. And she has a deep faith, but also feels like she's not supported in it. And that's just...
You mean for the abolition of the death penalty?
Yeah, has not found support within the religious community in general. Hmm. So that's been frustrating.
Well, thank you very much. Yes.
Last question. The people that you were taking then, were those that were non-violent crimes?
We handled misdemeanor and felony offenses, both violent, property and violent.
Murder, rape, and those types of things?
Anything from...
There's other alternatives that have been suggested as ways of approaching more the restoration of the restoration of the relationship between victim and offender to the point before the crime had taken place. For example, restitution is something that's been a program in Minnesota for a number of years now. And there's been some talk, some feeling that this ought to be extended to even replace a punishment model or replace a system of punishment with systems of restitution. But again, it's dealing with people's basic morals and values. The idea that punishment is something that maybe we add to just simple restitution. In other words, that there has to be something, some people feel there has to be something more added to just simply restoring the victim to their place as a way or a sign to the rest of us or to the society that some wrong has been done.
Pretty tough to have a murder victim restored in their regular place.
Well, this you think about this, that a murder, of course, the example that Mary was just giving for, there, that especially if somebody is who's murdered is responsible for a family or responsible for other dependents, then restitution would in some sense have to do with the offender taking over those responsibilities in one way or another, those responsibilities toward the dependents. Again, when we're dealing with death, of course, we're dealing with something that I think most of us feel is maybe a little a quantum difference than other types of crimes, which leads us into today's topic about the death penalty. I wanted to ask you, how many of you think are ambivalent about the death penalty, that you don't really know for sure what your feelings are? How many of you have have an opinion that you're pretty set with? Well, most of you have opinions. Well, good, then I'm sure that we'll have a lot of contributions. The death penalty is charged with emotion, and especially so in recent years. And I think this is a sign of something we were talking about yesterday, and that was the progress of civilization and the more humane treatment of some people by other people within a society, and the progression of values, values of equality, values of freedom and liberty and so on, that that go along with this, that have been in progress in Western civilization for several hundred years now. It doesn't seem that we're going to be able to turn the clock back in these areas. But the death penalty for a lot of people then, I think, is a symbol of something. It's a, it's not just, it's just not the carrying out of an activity by the criminal justice system, but it symbolizes something over and beyond that. If we, at the personal level, for example, we may identify ourselves with the victim. Sometimes we may identify ourselves with the executioner, the people that are involved, the offender. One time I was taking a class through San Quentin, and the fellow that was showing us around was in there for a double murder. And he was we visited where the gas chamber at the end of the tour. And he asked the students, he said, he says, if you had to be involved in this one way or another, would you want your friend or your relative to be the victim or the offender in a murder? And it made the students stop and think a little bit and examine their own values in this. But he was, of course, being involved himself personally. He was trying to get us to understand what that was like. At the moral level, there's these two sides, these conflicting opinions, that in the retribution model, that there's a statement about in the Bibles, he who sheds the blood of man shall by man's something's blood be shed. I don't know how that goes exactly. But it's the idea that a wrong or a killing must be answered by another killing. That this sort of restores a balance in nature then, and that people don't feel that the justice or morality has been carried out unless this is done. And then on the social level, there's a lot of justification for the death penalty based on preserving the social order, that maybe it's something that protects us, it's our protection. there's certain times that it's, being that the social order is unequal, there's certain times that it's okay to kill. And the state kills often, especially in terms of war or other more justified circumstances. Then there's other times that it's not okay to kill. This is in a society like ours that's very large and has a lot of subcultures within it. This is going to vary from one area of the United States to another. And I wanted to get back to that in a little while. And then those people who are in favor of the abolition of the death penalty, it also is very symbolic to them. And what is the response? When we say we are for one of these, we're for the death penalty, we're against the death penalty, I think we also have to recognize as Christians our responsibility doesn't stop there. If we're for the death penalty, then somehow we have to minister to the family of the person who is executed. If we are against the death penalty, then it's also our responsibility to minister to the family of the victim. And in other words, the knife cuts both ways. Well, some of the, I wanted to mention some of the sociological research that's been done on the death penalty, because no matter what your opinion is, it's always nice to back it up by facts. Or maybe you don't need facts for your opinion. But the Amnesty International has done a study of the use of the death penalty in the world in the latter part of the 1970s. And this is what they call the geography of the death penalty. In other words, how it's distributed around the world in its uses. And they find that in general, well, not in general. They found that those countries that use the death penalty the most represent pretty seedy. The death penalty. Those countries that are heavily involved in the death penalty are those countries that we don't really think too much of in terms of human rights or in terms of progress of the kinds of democratic values that we hold in this country. Some countries, of course, don't report, or it's difficult to get a gauge on how much the death penalty is used. This is especially true in Central American or South American countries that have semi-official death squads that go around and knock on the door at night and take people, and then they're never seen again. This is, of course, the use of executions or death for political purposes, but it's not recorded in the statistics, so we can't really compare them that way. But those countries that do keep pretty good statistics, the leading country in the world in terms of executions is South Africa, the Union of South Africa. And you can guess that the Union of South Africa, being that it's an apartheid society and the social order there is very strictly racially segregated, that the death penalty reflects that too. So that in 1978 there were 132 executions in the Union of South Africa. There was only one white that was executed. This is comparable to the use of the death penalty through history in the southern United States, where the numbers of executions carried out over the years and the crimes for which those executions represent are skewed racially also, so that, for example, the death penalty for rape, since 1900, there's never been a white executed in southern United States for the crime of rape, although there were 3,000 blacks executed for this reason. Of the 15 Western European nations, only three of them carry out or execute. France, even though they may have the death penalty on the books, they don't use it. Some of these countries, anyway. France, Greece, and Turkey, in the period that the Amnesty International study covered, were the only countries that were executing. Greece and Turkey, of course, are quite far removed from central Western Europe. Oppressive police states, of course, use the death penalty, whether they're right-wing or left-wing. Cuba uses the death penalty to a large extent, so does Haiti, and they both represent dictatorships of the far left and the far right. Two countries that don't execute are very interesting. One of these is Israel, which has not executed anybody since Adolf Eichmann. and you consider the kind of situation that Israel finds itself in, this constant fear of and constant preparedness for war and the kinds of terrorism that take place, it's very interesting that Israel has been able to refrain from using the death penalty. Another country that doesn't use the death penalty is West Germany. And again, you might say, well, that comes out of the response to the Nazi era. Somebody was bringing that up yesterday, too. But so West Germany, Germany itself, prior to the end of World War II, which was heavily involved in executing socially unwanted people. I don't know if anybody's here had the chance to visit some of the prison camps or a prison camp that is left over from or kept as a monument to the Nazi era. But I happened one year to visit Dachau, which is just outside of Munich, and there was a sculpture out there used the symbols that the prisoners had to wear that indicated why they were in the prison. And of course, there were Jews. There were five classes of prisoners. I don't know if I can remember them all, but one class was Jews. Then there were homosexuals. Then there were clergymen. And then, I can't remember the fourth one, but the fifth one at the bottom of the list were antisocial. So I guess that was sort of the wastebasket category. Well, the conclusion Amnesty International made, of course, you could probably guess from the findings that I've mentioned, that there's a very strong correlation between the use of execution or the use of the death penalty and human rights violations in countries. They seem to go hand in hand. One conclusion that Amnesty International made was that the use of the death penalty may be one way of taking a country's moral temperature to see where it's at in terms of this progress of civilization that we've been talking about, or that we talked about yesterday. In the United States, there's a great variation from region to region. There's several states that have abolished the death penalty, and then there's other states that have not. But also, murder rates vary greatly from section to section in the United States. And I mentioned this yesterday, that murder rates and execution rates seem to go hand in hand. Which I think, you know, it would depend on how you want to explain this, and people explain it in different ways. But in other words, those parts of the country that seem to have high murder rates are also those parts of the country that use the death penalty to a greater extent than other parts or other states. Violence, I guess it was Eldridge Cleaver said, was as American as apple pie. And that's reflected in a lot of our customs in this country. In a way,
murder.
Yeah. These drunk flies they have up here, must be the mountain air. It's astounding if you look at the numbers of murders in our large cities compared to Western European cities. New York averages like over 1,000 murders a year. The city I come from, Oakland, California, which only has like 300,000 people, usually averages about 100 murders a year. Paris, London, average less than 10 every year. If you can imagine that, what it would be like to live in a city where there's only maybe 5, 6, 7 murders a year. In a city as large as New York City. It's reflected in a lot of other parts of our culture too, the use of guns. I think a lot of it has to do with the fear of the state, that we don't like state authority over us. On the boat on the way up here the other day, I was talking to a fellow who lives in Wenatchee, who has a cabin in up the Stehekin, yeah. And he was, he seemed to be a very law-abiding type of fellow, you know, that you could usually meet out in these areas like rural Washington. And he was saying how offended he was when he was up fishing in one place and in the mountains around here, and a game warden came walking up to him and said, "Can I see your fishing license?" And he says, "No." You know, Americans, you know, like if you put a sign on the lawn that says, "Do not walk on this lawn," Americans are going to walk. across it, you know, and somebody in the United States, you might find somebody that says, or there might be a, I think the further away you get from the seat of, you know, our cultures, which for most of us is Western Europe, the more you find this alienation from the state. I visited Australia one Christmas, and down there they don't even put signs on the lawns. When the Queen made her tour of the Commonwealth at one of the centennial tours a few years ago, Australia was the only country that said they didn't want her to visit. And there's that independence that we feel, that we want to take care of our own problems. But unfortunately, in the areas of the United States that you find violence considered to be an appropriate way to handle personal difficulties, you're going to find high murder rates. And then the use of the death penalty will be greater in those areas, too. If you have any questions or any comments, jump right in. I wanted to say a little bit about deterrence. The use of the death penalty for purposes of deterring murder. Social scientists, historians or philosophers that argue in favor of the death penalty generally make the statement that it's our protection, that it's the thing, it's our sort of insurance policy against the thing that protects us or insulates us from violence. But the facts don't seem to show that. If I ask you this question, how many of you believe that the death penalty deters? And then I ask the corresponding question, how many of you believe that the death penalty actually promotes murder? Many of you may not have thought about that. Historically, most of the studies that have been done have been in terms of does it deter. Only recently have studies come out to try to investigate the question of how much murder does the death penalty promote. How much, in fact, if we look at this other side of it, rather than protecting us or insulating us from the possibility of being a murder victim or our friends and loved ones being murder victims, how much does the death penalty make it more likely that we are going to be victims of murder? Most of the studies in terms of deterrence are, you know, comparing murder rates in countries or states when the abolition comes in. You know, what was the murder rate before the death penalty was voted out? And then what's the murder rate afterwards? Or comparing contiguous states, like in the United States. States that are similar in cultural base, one state may have the death penalty, or one state does have the death penalty, the other state does not. And then what is the difference between the murder rates? Those studies always fail to show that the death penalty deters. But more recently, sociologists have been doing studies to find out what happens to the murder rate after an execution. If it's supposed to be a model, you know, or to deter us. One study done in Florida after John Speckelink, who was one of the first ones executed after the Supreme Court raised the moratorium on the death penalty, discovered that the murder rate jumped 16% in Florida right after that execution. Within 14 days after the execution, the murder rate jumped 16%.
How many murders occur in Florida?
I don't know. I don't know that figure. Maybe it would just be two or three murders, it might jump at that much. But a more interesting study, that's a good question. I don't have the answer to that.
And since the moratorium, how many blacks have been executed as opposed to whites in comparison to 3,000 you mentioned for rape?
I don't know. Do you?
I don't think many.
I wanted to get back to that, though, in a different sense, because that's a kind of a knotty problem that seems to have been unraveled by some recent research. There was another study done of the number of murders in New York State after each the researchers studied or looked at the number of murders after every execution since 1930 in New York State, and discovered that after each execution, the average number of murders went up 3 to 4 murders after each execution.
Let's just make sure that we keep our statistics straight and remember that correlation does not imply causation also.
That's right.
And there are a lot of other factors going on, and just, you know, research is research.
Research and statistics, rightly, do not show causation. But beyond that, they also need interpretation. So if that's the statistic, we could agree that that, let's say that for, you know, we investigate the research and find that it's valid, that that in fact is a true finding, that after each execution, the average increase in murders is from 3 to 4. How do we interpret that? If those who are obviously don't want to find evidence that the death penalty is not useful will interpret it one way, other people will interpret it the other, another. In general, we could say, the way that I generally look at this is that, is points I've been making earlier, that the executions and murder rates go hand in hand, not necessarily because one is causing the other, but because they're both results of this, of another phenomenon. And that other phenomenon is a general cultural consensus that violence is an appropriate way to handle disputes. There was another study done of back when San Quentin, which there's another scheduled execution in San Quentin coming up very soon, but back in the days when the death penalty in the 1940s and 50s was used to a much greater extent, there was another study done of what happened to the number of murders in the Bay Area after each execution at San Quentin. And San Quentin always executed at noon on Fridays. And so the researchers would look at what happened to the number of murders on Saturday and Sunday, or from Friday night to Sunday, through Sunday. And again, they found this corresponding finding that the number of murders went up after an execution in general.
Well, wouldn't you assume that on a weekend that there would be more murders than during a normal week? That's potentially the nights when people are out and about.
Well, that's true, except that if you compare it to the weekends that there's no execution and you find a difference. But there's, you know, there's even a more interesting study that was done. And again, as I say it, you need to interpret this in a different way. The number of murders increase after each heavyweight championship fight in the United States. And it's a very strong and well-researched and with high-powered statistics that show this. And the researchers that did this study then tried to extend it to other examples of public violence. And so they looked at fights that weren't necessarily heavyweight championship. They used heavyweight championship fights at first because these are the ones that get most of the publicity. So then they extended it to fights that weren't heavyweight championship fights but also had received great amounts of publicity, and they found the same findings. And then they also studied the death penalty and found similar statistics that corresponded to that. These researchers interpreted it in terms of what they call the Tylenol effect. And if you remember when this, or they also use the example of this, you all remember this, when somebody contaminated a bottle of Tylenol, and then all of a sudden in different places in the United States this thing reoccurred. Well, it couldn't be the same person running around doing that. But, and if you remember the razor blades in candy at Halloween time, that it's publicized, and then all of a sudden you have this some people who seem they want their glory too or something. I guess they want to get in the paper and do something like this. Again, the interpretation is not given by the statistics. In other words, we have to apply that interpretation ourselves. You were going to say something.
I was just going to say it sounds as though the research is telling us that perhaps we should do our executions less publicly. Keep the deterrent alive by making sure that the people who are out there committing murder know that they're going to pay with their own lives. But if people are seeking publicity, and, you know.
That refutes his point then, that it would seem to, I don't agree that it does, that the society does not see, or does see violence as a way of resolving conflict. But it still says violence is okay. If you accept his premise, which you do.
Well, wasn't one of the problems initially that you'd have someone kill somebody and I'm talking about ancient times, and then the family would feel, the other family, the person who was killed, would then have to take the law in their own hands and in turn kill that person.
Well, that probably was the law. I mean, they probably weren't taking the law into their own hands. That was the law. It was their moral duty to avenge the killing.
But not necessarily to the person that actually did the killing, just to the family. Don't we take that out of it? I think something similar happened in Louisiana. Somebody's daughter had been raped or taken and killed, and when the guy came back, the father shot the subject. I don't know if
I heard that case too. I can't remember the details of it, but
I
heard the fellow interviewed on the radio.
Society would like to. Society should handle that kind of problem, not individuals anyway.
There was a case in California this year where a fellow who had been in high school had killed a real popular couple who were seniors in high school. And I think the fellow was student body president and or whatever. Anyway, the couple that was killed were very popular in the community. And he was a young fellow himself, a high school student. He was sentenced to life imprisonment, and he spent quite a long time in prison. And then it became a case because he was up for parole. And then the question became, can the state, like in the form of government officials, overturn the parole board and violate the law in the sense that says on the books that the person should be able to get out after a certain period of time. And so the governor, wanting, of course, to appeal or be popular with the public, initially overturned the parole board, but then the court ruled that he couldn't do that because it was the law and that this person had a right to get out of prison. Not only that, but prison officials said, I was touring some prisons at that time, and they said this was really an important case to them, because if it turns out that you do your good time and you follow the rules the way you're supposed to, if you're an inmate in the prison, and then you're not going to get out anyway, it would really cause problems for their ability to control inmates within prisons. But that night, he was let out at 12 midnight, so that he would be out the day that he was due to be out. Relatives of the couple that had been killed gathered at the gate of the prison, and they were incensed. You know, that's the only way you could describe it. They couldn't come to grips with what was happening, that this person was going to be released from prison that had killed their friends or their relatives. And I think, you know, you're right. We have to take that into account. We have to take these feelings of these people into account. And as I began by saying that I think this is our responsibility, if whatever side we come down on this thing, that we have a responsibility to the people who are affected by whatever our decision is or whatever our political and moral opinion is. That's interesting you should bring that up. I had forgotten to mention that I first started thinking about this connection between the use of the death penalty and the increase in murder rates, not because of these studies, but because I heard a psychiatrist from Stanford one time give a talk. And it's exactly what he pointed out. He said that people who want to end their own lives but find suicide morally repugnant, or you know that they just can't stand that idea, sometimes will, if the death penalty exists, they want to end everything. They kill their most loved one, like their wife or their husband or someone that's close to them. And the idea is, this is the final act of my existence too, that after I do this, I have no future either, and I will die. And he felt that it was for that reason that the death penalty was would increase or make it more likely that murders would take place. But that was at the level that you're talking about, at the individual psycho-emotional level, rather than this, like this Tylenol effect, where you have some crazy faddists out there. An interesting study was done by an anthropologist of murder in Houston, Texas, which generally has the highest murder rate in the United States, and from year to year. And what he did was to take every case of murder and investigate it in circumstances that he could. I think there were like over 400 cases of murder. And he found, you know, and this is support for my hypothesis having to do with the acceptance of violence and the use of execution going hand in hand, because Texas is one of those states that does execute a higher percentage of its convicted murderers than other states. And so we'd think that, well, obviously Texas authorities react quickly and severely to murder by employing the death penalty. But he discovered, and his by investigating these murders, that the most common sentence for murder in Houston, Texas, was no bill at all. In other words, nothing. The grand jury never brought an indictment, or maybe the police would present their evidence, and there would be no indictment coming out of it. And the reason for that was because most of the murders were considered within the culture of that state to be acceptable.
You're saying homicide is the same as murder.
Homicide, right. Murder is not a legal term, but homicide is. So we could stick with homicide. Because most murders were between friends and loved ones. And Texas happens to be one of those states that is most forthright in stating that interference from the government is not desired. And so, being the government officials are also citizens, and of the same culture, they would interpret these murders as being perfectly acceptable. Because if you look at the circumstances, that was what the appropriate behavior was in that circumstance. In Texas law, it's okay for a husband to kill his wife if he finds her in flagrant delict, or whatever they call it, and also kill the other man that's involved. And that's not against the law. Texas also has a stand and fight or something like that law, that if you decide to protect your property by standing there and killing somebody, then that's acceptable too. Where the state steps in then is with those kinds of murders that don't fit, but that fit in with the culture on the other side that are particularly repugnant to the people. And the one, of course, that would be the greatest in this regard would be a black person killing a white person. And so the issue that you brought up, having to do with the number of blacks that are executed and the number of whites that are executed, is not where this is kind of a knotty problem that has been difficult to come to grips with. But what seems to be apparent is that it's not who the offender is, and this is very consistent research that has been brought out just recently in the last few months. It's not who the offender is; it's who the victim is. If the victim is a valued member, if they have a higher status in the community, if they're a government official, if they are white, or if they represent any of these classes of people that are on the upper end of the social order, then the person who committed the murder will be more likely to be executed. So the argument that, it's not, you know, how many blacks are on death row, how many whites are on death row, is not the issue now, but it's because that's been explained in terms of the victim. Murder rate, or homicide, if we want to stick with that term, is highly present in the black community. In northern American cities, rates of homicide and violence in black ghettos is extremely high. One study in Philadelphia of young black males concluded that it was highly probable that males lived beyond 22, 23 years old in these ghettos because of the high rates of violence. Other means of death too that are accident and so on. So if a black kills a black in Houston, Texas, it's not as big of an issue. It sort of fits in with the expectations.
Just add something that I also want to say. There's just too much we didn't talk about white collar crime at all. It's a whole other area. If you look at the kinds of deaths that are caused in the workplace, poor working conditions, coal mining, all kinds of stuff. That's a whole other area of, I think, to think about.
Right. I think that's important, too.
And I mean, your job can be as dangerous to you as being on the streets. It's for some.
And long-term effects of that, too, as we've seen in the asbestos cases. The companies that hid the medical information that the workers were suffering from these diseases because of their work conditions, and they failed to tell the workers that. And over a 20, 30, 40 year period, these illnesses would occur, and they wouldn't tell them why they were occurring. The Supreme Court has been really ambivalent about this in recent years. There was a moratorium on the death penalty for a number of years due to the fact that it was considered to be used disproportionately against the poor and blacks and so on, other ethnic groups. So states rewrote their laws to try to bring some equality in terms of the use of the death penalty. And so that now the appeals to stay executions are based on proportionality in another sense, and that has to do with the gravity of the crime. And so states have to prove that this person being executed committed a crime that is more grave than those people who have not been executed, that the person's crime is not less grave than those persons who have not been executed, which is just another way of putting it. The Supreme Court is, in other words, into this business of trying to weigh these things and balance them. Again, it's this meaning of justice that not a lot of people relate to personally, but maybe legalistically, that you take everybody's interests into account and strike some balance. Well, nobody's satisfied, but it may be a legalistic interpretation of justice. Well, the title of this talk is Christianity and the Death Penalty, too. And the synod that I belong to, the Lutheran Church in America, has been on record against the use of capital punishment since 1966, which is 18 years now. They base this on the idea that the state has a right to take or not to take life. And so if it decides not to take life, it's not violating its moral precepts. Other justifications having to do with human equality before the law, that they felt that the death penalty at that time was used disproportionately and therefore was a miscarriage of justice, which it was. And also the inability of, that once the death penalty is carried out, how do we restore that offender to the community? How do we reconcile the community again? We can't. The life has been lost. In primitive tribes, if a murder takes place within the tribe, execution does not take place. It's only then there's a development of clans and families, family clans, and so and blood feuds that are beyond that. But within a tribe, repayment is always done in terms of goods. Either livestock or agricultural goods of one sort or another, to try to restore a balance. One method, the newer, a tribe in Eastern Africa, when a murder takes place, the murderer finds refuge in the tent of the prophet, which would be like a prophet in the Old Testament, someone who lacks any kind of a state authority. There's no police department or anything like that. But the person's authority exists because the community supports that authority. And once they don't support that authority anymore, there's nothing that a prophet can do. But the offender takes refuge in the tent of the prophet. And then the prophet tries to get the various sides together and come to some mutual agreement on what the family of the one person should repay to the family of the other person to restore a balance. And as civilization goes on and as legal institutions come about and as they're proliferated in modern society, you find the individual standing more and more alone before the law. So rather, if in olden times, and this idea of blood feuds and so on. If a person commits a murder, it's his family's responsibility and the family's responsibility of the victim to do something about it. But in modern societies, we stand alone before the law. There's nobody that takes our side or takes our place. And so it's very difficult to see how community or social balance is to be restored through the application of the law. And the other justification they used was had to do with the invalidity of deterrence theory when it comes to the use of the death penalty. The American Lutheran Church, I know, has published a statement just recently in favor of abolishing the death penalty, too. Pardon?
I don't think it passed.
Oh, didn't it? I don't know. I wasn't aware of that. Well, what do you have to contribute? Those of you who have opinions, upon what do you base them? He shouldn't be allowed to live. Do you want to kill him?
Well, I don't know. I'm not arguing that.
No, I know what you mean. I don't know how we answer those questions without getting at what, you know, our personal stance is and perspective is on these things. Yes.
Just want to say, it's really easy to get emotional and important to get emotional about the taking of life. And the first response when you get emotional is to want to punish somebody. I know, having just experienced being mugged once, that my initial response was, you know, rationally when I think about it, I'm for forgiveness, and I think I feel that emotionally too, but my first initial response was to want that person to be punished.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more you get to know a person, the more easy it is to forgive them, to face them. And I wonder with the death penalty, if we as Christians don't sometimes put our faith aside when we say we're for the death penalty. How can we say we're for the death penalty and listen to Jesus saying, turn the other cheek? Which doesn't mean let this person come back and murder people again, but which says, offer yourself to that person. Or when, I wonder if when they were going to stone the adulterers, if Christ would have had any different of a response had it been a murderer. I don't think that Christ's power to forgive was so limited that he wouldn't have said the same thing had it been a murderer.
Speaking personally, I can remember the first time that my first understanding of the, well, growing up, you know, in the society of the cowboys and Indians, and you know, you play those games a lot, and so death and killing is something that we all play at a very early age, and we find acceptable because of the definition of this other group. You know, if you're a cowboy, then you have the right to kill an Indian. On the other side, if the next day you're the Indian, then you have the right to kill cowboys, or cops and robbers is the same thing. But how would you divide up the population into these classes and say, well, some people are okay to kill and other people aren't, depending on which side you're on? And it's so true that in certain areas of the world this still goes on. The Middle East is a perfect example of that, and it makes you sick to your stomach to watch this cycle of vengeance, of killing that just never stops. If you ever get the chance to see a movie that it came out a couple years ago and won the Academy Award as the Best Foreign Picture of the Year, called Yol, Y-O-L, and it's a Turkish movie, and the people that made that movie were in jail at the time they made it, and being that they have a different system of criminal justice, they tend to allow people to carry on their occupations while they're in jail. And so the filmmakers went around in portable jail cells and made this film. But the film shows this horrible social conditions that these people live under, where they're burdened by these previous generations and these blood feuds that just never stop. And just the movie traces the plot is that five prisoners come out of prison on parole, not on parole, but on furlough. And they have 2 weeks to go back and visit their families, and then they have to come back to the jail in 2 weeks. So then it traces what happens to each of these as they go back. And in a couple cases, you see the wife beating that goes on, the acceptability of maintaining the social order and the position of women in the society, the public beatings of women as a way of maintaining and asserting where their place is in the society. But on the other hand, you see how people sacrifice what they consider to be more valued or important ideals and sacrifice them to the system of vengeance. In one case, a man comes home and his relatives tell him, your wife has been unfaithful. Now you have to kill her. And they know that he's been in jail and probably he hasn't watched this go on, so he probably doesn't have this hatred or feelings that can support this. So they're very eager to carry out this for him. Let us do it, his brothers say. We'll do it quickly. You know, let us, you don't have to do it. And then his mother comes to him and says, no, don't let them do it. Nurture your hatred and let it live with you until you get it to the point where you can do it. And so he does. And then in another case, a young man comes home to his village, and it's one of these battles that's going on between the government and the rebels. And at night, the rebels go out, and you hear gunfire. And the next day, the government soldiers bring the rebels into the village and dump these sons of these mothers in the middle of the village. And they watch to see who comes and claims the bodies, because whoever comes and claims those bodies then become identified as enemies of the state. So nobody can claim the bodies. And so in this one case, the courtship that takes place is not open like in our society, but it's just the glances that a boy and a girl make in the marketplace toward one another. And then when they feel that they want to get married, then they approach their parents respectively, but they've never even communicated during this time among themselves. And so you watch this go on, this communication between this young man and woman in the village square. And it develops to the point where they're planning to get married, and then the fellow's brother is one of those soldiers, or one of those rebels that gets killed. So according to Islamic law, he has to marry his brother's wife and take over her place. And so he has to forego what he considered to be his true desires in this area. And in each case of these soldiers, you see, or of these prisoners in their daily lives, you see the system and how it intrudes on what people consider to be fine and higher level values, and reduce them to nothing more than instruments to carry out these age-old systems of feuds and bloodletting. That's what can happen. I mean, that's the level that the society can, that those ancient societies found themselves in. And the other day when we were talking about the progress of civilization yesterday, I think, we were trying to say that a lot of these things we don't agree with anymore. And we seem to want to promote something better than that. And I think, as the fellow mentioned back there, our Christian values have been very instrumental throughout history in bringing about that progress. You can't dissociate the influence of Christianity on Western civilization over against the influence of other changes that have taken place and say which ones have been more important in producing these feelings toward the abolition of the death penalty. Yes?
I have this feeling. Years ago, my house was broken into, and my bedroom was a shambles, and all my desk things pulled apart, and nothing taken but a little camera. And I had such feelings of being violated, as if I had been raped almost. That idea of man's inhumanity to man. Now I didn't feel that man should be executed. I hate to say, I don't know how I'd feel if my son was murdered, or my mother had been murdered, but I do think that we are beginning to see crimes of various kinds in a different light than maybe we used to. I mean, why should that be a lower crime than the one who took something of greater value or killed someone?
I think your experience is very valid. I've talked to people who, when their house or their bedroom was broken into, they weren't able to even go in that bedroom again. Or touch the things that somebody else had touched.
That's where you have to change the values of the society and start instilling them in the young people so that they have the regard for the values of other people and the objects of others.
I think that's
dropped
right.
For some period of time or made less prominent.
That's right. crime is so rampant in our society that I doubt whether there's anybody in this room that hasn't been touched very directly by it at one time or another. Well, we better stop here. Does anybody else want to say something quickly?
When you were mentioning in Texas where they have the law where the person can stand and shoot to protect his, or if it has been found his wife, or, is there any decrease in adultery or in burglaries in that case?
I can tell you right off the top of my head, nothing any society has ever done in history has touched adultery. We've never been able to handle that one. Well, why don't we stop here then? And I hope, even though this session is over, that if you still have questions, maybe you can talk to your friends or to me about them.